Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. A pregnant woman with mental illness delivered her child alone in a Broward County jail cell not too long ago. The woman says corrections personnel were aware that she was near term. She says personnel at the jail could hear her cries for help as she went into labor. In a letter to the Broward Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Gregory Tony, obtained by our news partners, the Miami Herald, the Broward County Public Defender Howard Finkelstein said this, quote, "It is unconscionable that any woman, particularly a mentally ill woman, would be abandoned in her call in her cell to deliver her own baby," unquote. Lack of access to health care for inmates held in South Florida prisons and jails is not uncommon. A lawsuit was recently filed by the family of a Coral Springs man who, according to the suit, died a slow, painful, and preventable death. 9 other cases of Broward County jail deaths were listed in the suit as being preventable and caused by negligence. Joining me now is Dr. Tanya Zacherson. She's a former trauma surgeon at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami, where she researched why inmates die from treatable illnesses. Dr. Zacherson, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Luis. It's a pleasure to be here.
You had already been doing this research for some time on this issue. I'm wondering your reaction. You hear this story about this woman having to give birth to her own child in the cell. People are there. They hear her. They know what's going on. I mean, what was your reaction to this? I'm wondering if this is common or is this a rare story?
Right. So when I read about that story, obviously I had the same reaction that, you know, most human beings would have. It's shocking and horrifying. But at the same time, it does not surprise me. Luis, we have to keep in mind that when we're talking about incarcerated men, women, and youth in this country in particular, we're talking about millions of people, in particular 2.3 million. So it's the largest incarcerated population on earth, but they're the most vulnerable population that we have in this country, especially when it comes to patient care, in my opinion.
Do we have data, by the way, because I want to say, just sticking with this story of this woman, do we have data? Do we know, again, how many women are expecting who are incarcerated, who are in any situation similar to this case?
That's a very good question. I'm not aware of any data because essentially when we capture data about who's incarcerated and what's going on behind bars, it's voluntary reporting. What I can comment on is the research we did, which worked backwards using information about inmates that had already died while incarcerated and learning from their deaths, what sort of situations they were facing. But in terms of people who are actually currently incarcerated, who needs medical attention, who is actually receiving the medical attention? Is that attention in a hospital or is it in the prison infirmary? Or are people left to their own devices within their own cells? We actually do not know as far as I'm aware. There's no trauma, emergency general surgery, or any sort of surgical database that captures those data or that information.
Why were you interested in trying to learn more about this particular issue? Why did you want to dive into this?
I will be completely frank and honest with you. This actually was the brainchild of my public health student, Dr. Alex Busco, who was at the University of Miami at the time. And he came to me after learning about the death of Darren Rainey. You may remember Darren Rainey was, I think, a 51 or 52-year-old gentleman with schizophrenia who was incarcerated for a nonviolent drug crime. He became psychotic because he had no access to his medications. He started acting out in his cell, and as punishment, the guards put him in the shower, as it's called, and scalded him to death. So he was tortured to death. So my public health student was outraged with this, as he should be, as we all should be, and said, "I wonder how often this is happening, Tanya." And so we said, "Well, let's take a look. I don't know either. Let's take a look. It's a great question." So we went to the medical examiner's office, where the information is public there, and we said, "Let's do a review over 7 years and just look at all the incarcerated inmates who have died and see why they died. What was their cause of death as recorded by the medical examiner?"
And by the way, all that information, I mean, you know, how accurate was it? I'm wondering, like, if there was any information that was missing or anything that surprised you about what you were looking at the data.
So to follow up with that, actually, that's an excellent question. We were surprised with the results, you know, of our findings, which was essentially that close to 1 in 4 incarcerated inmate was dying because of preventable surgical or traumatic illness or injury. And only a third of those people were actually accessing surgical or had surgical intervention prior to dying. So what I'm talking about is cases of people dying from a groin hernia. That was one case that was recorded. Like, cause of death, inguinal hernia. And that really should not happen in anywhere in the United States.
Or, I mean, if somebody has that, then I mean, because if you're seeing that and you're thinking that, wait a minute, that should, that's treatable.
Correct.
Then what would have to happen for someone, for that situation to lead them to death then?
Gross negligence and a denial of surgical care, period. And what was even more concerning is because the date range of our study was between 2008 to 2014, we said, oh, Darren Rainey's chart will be included in this. So we looked for it and we actually requested it because we knew he was part of the database, again, which was what prompted the study. And we were flat out denied access to his chart. And so what is concerning with that is if he died under because he was tortured to death, how often is that happening to other inmates? What other charts are we missing and not getting access to? And so there's a whole bunch of questions that arise from this research, more than answers that are provided.
Was anybody able to give you any answer on that, though? Do we have any idea of how many cases we may not know about?
We do not. Not anything that anyone locally in Miami-Dade was willing to give. And then if you think about it on a national level, we have the Bureau of Justice Statistics that collects data on incarcerated individuals from 50 states, and they look at who's died and whatnot. But all of that reporting is voluntary. And the variability between what states are reporting what is phenomenal. So we actually have no clear idea as to who is dying while they're incarcerated and what they're dying from. And who's dying violent deaths as a result of mistreatment, abuse, neglect, or negligence, or just not accessing care in a timely fashion. It's very, very difficult to know, even though these are extremely basic questions involving human rights.
And you talked about some of the different cases that you saw, at least what had been reported. Did anything really jump out at you? Was there anything shocking?
I think the most shocking thing was that we're dealing with like 51% of our patient population had mental illness. But what was shocking was that we were seeing cases like literally like groin hernias or bowel obstructions as listed as causes of death, stab wound to the abdomen, things that really, you know, if you access surgical or medical treatment in a timely fashion, no one should be dying from this at all.
I'm talking with Dr. Tanya Zacherson. She's a former trauma surgeon at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami. And last year, her and a group of researchers from the University of Miami studied a number of autopsy reports, as we've been talking about now, and found that inmates in Miami-Dade County jails and prisons die in part because they lack adequate access to timely health care. Lots of questions about how people are dying in those prisons. So, you know what, Dr. Zacherson, then, you know, we look at this, and I guess the first question that comes to mind for me is this: what kind of health care do prisoners have exactly? Can we tell from the data what's available?
That's an excellent question. Sadly, we cannot, because again, we're working backwards. These are death reports, if you will. So it's hard to know. I know there's variability with what's available on a jail level, what's available on a state prison level or federal prison level. Normally, when an inmate is injured or unwell, they will be transported to Jackson Memorial Hospital, or they should come into the hospital.
What about when you start with the first thing, the first layer, I guess, which is the infirmary. But what is in the infirmary? What do they have access to there before they go to a hospital?
So an infirmary would be like a basic clinic, as far as I understand. And I'm not an expert of healthcare within the prison system at all. But it certainly is not something like a hospital where you could access, where you would have access to surgical intervention. Like you would have someone to a surgeon to operate on you or an anesthesiologist to care for you. Like it's not set up that way. It's just basic first aid type of things. And then I think the infirmary would be really where the decision is made. You know what, this patient isn't getting better. They need to go actually be transported to the hospital, or they are improving. They can go back to their cell. The question is how many people actually make it to the infirmary or from the infirmary to the hospital or just stay in their cell. We do not know.
Does the data tell you in how many cases the patient needed surgery?
We think it does. Again, we're dealing with unverified data. We're going based on what the medical examiner has written. But when we're seeing all of the cases of surgical illness or trauma, and we know that these cases required surgery to help the patient and save the patient, and when we're seeing that only a third of those patients who died actually received the indicated surgical procedure, that becomes a problem. Now, it could be that all of the patients actually received surgical interventions and just it wasn't recorded properly. We don't know, but it's kind of suspicious and concerning.
Does the data tell us anything about perhaps a disparity in treatment for people, based on their gender or race?
So that's also an interesting question, Luis. Our patient population that we studied, our cohort, as we call it, was very reflective of the prison population in the United States. So locally in Miami-Dade County, our cohort was largely male, but they were disproportionately men of color. So 40% were Black, considered, again, Haitian, African-American, or Black Hispanic. And that's double, I think, the local population in Miami. And then another 40% were Hispanic. So this is a reflection, again, of the larger problem we have in the United States of mass incarceration of both men and women of color.
Do we know, and I know that because you mentioned to me a second ago that you don't know all the inner workings of healthcare within the system, but I'm curious also if you do about funding for healthcare coverage available to inmates, what do we know is supposed to be available to them? Do we have that, any idea of that?
So by statutes and laws, actually, that have gone up to the Supreme Court, we know that men and women who are incarcerated have the right to health care, and that's any health care that's required or needed, whether it's surgical intervention, if they need an operation, if they need antibiotics or any care. They have the right to all care that any other human being would have the right to. So that's stipulated. What they actually receive, again, I just don't think anyone really knows.
Now, I mean, you had this data that you looked at, but you've also, I mean, as a surgeon, as a doctor, you've worked with inmates treating them.
Correct.
I wondered if you ever talked to them or if you had the chance to hear what they told you about what life was like and healthcare was like behind bars.
So that's also a very good question. And of course, there are anecdotal stories that come to mind, again, non-scientific and non-quantified, but cases of, you know, young men who have had previous surgery, who have had bowel obstructions, that's where their intestines get kinked or knotted because of scar tissue on the inside, and you become very sick, you start to vomit, and you become very dry or dehydrated. But I remember in particular one young man in clinic who came in and he was having ongoing abdominal pain. We ended up admitting him because we knew that he wouldn't be, you know, properly treated back in prison, and he needed support and fluids and treatment. But he told me the story about how he had been writhing around on the floor of the infirmary in prison for hours and hours prior to being transported in, and that there was a definite delay. Now, he didn't die, obviously. So I think our study points to the larger question. If our study has shown that two-thirds of inmates that required surgical intervention to survive did not receive that, how many more are being harmed? Or what is, that's the mortality part, but what is the morbidity or simply harm part of people who don't even die? How prevalent is that of, just like this patient I was talking to who was saying, you know, I was left on the floor for hours writhing around in pain. Because who are they going to call? 911 to get an ambulance? They're the most vulnerable patient population we have in this country.
Is this research going to continue? Because one of the things that I mentioned is you're leaving.
I'm going to University of Chicago, yes.
The Windy City. You're leaving sunny South Florida for the Windy City.
Yes.
But, I mean, congratulations on that. But will this research continue?
It will, because the study we did is actually the first of its kind, as far as we know. So again, it's a patient population that's highly the most vulnerable, but also very, very understudied. So we are definitely carrying on with this research up in Chicago. I have a lot of colleagues up in Chicago, other trauma surgeons there too, that are very interested in looking into this. And it also, it just raises questions about all urban centers and cities across the country. Like what we're seeing in Miami-Dade County, I do not believe is unique only to Miami-Dade County. And we're probably seeing this, and we will probably expect to see this across the board as we continue this research.
You know, the other thing too, I mean, I'm thinking next steps here is even with the information that you have gathered, I mean, has it gotten to any state officials, local officials? Has it gotten to the people who can actually do something about it? How do we get that information to their hands at least?
Well, so that's a deeper political question, yeah. And that's a very good question. My personal opinion is that I think on a very local level, there's not necessarily much change that it can occur. It should occur, of course, but once again, we're dealing with the most incarcerated population, the largest incarcerated population on Earth. So we have 500,000 more incarcerated individuals in this country than they do in China, which has a population of 1.2 billion. What's going on in Miami-Dade is going on in other parts of Florida. It's going on in California. It's going on in New York City. It's going on in Chicago. This is a systemic problem that needs addressing on a far larger scale. So I would take it up to the top as we approach 2020 and really think that this is a phenomenal human rights issue that affects so many individuals in this country, both men and women, and take it at that level.
Again, talking with Dr. Tanya Zachrisson, former trauma surgeon at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami. You can learn more about her study on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Again, fascinating looking at this data and just asking the question, again, what sort of health care do inmates have? Not just in Miami-Dade, but throughout the country, as she pointed out. And stories like the ones that we pointed out kind of do make you think about that. Dr. Zachrisson, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Luis, for having me.
Good luck to you again as you head off to your new adventure.
Thank you so much.
All right. Still to come, we're going to go down to the Florida Keys for a story about a hotel fire and charges of a businessman tossing construction trash into the ocean. More on that coming up next on Sundial.